The talks for lifting sanctions on Iran with the P4+1 are happening in Vienna. Whether there has been progress or not depends on the source. While one report says that 70 to 80% of the text is written, Iran's lead negotiator says it's not over till it's over, in so many words. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at how close or how far the two sides are in these sanction lifting talks, and whether Israel or Republican lawmakers in the U.S. will be the stumbling block in these talks. Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. We have Sid Mohammed Marandi, who's a university professor and political analyst, joining us. Also joining us, Marcus Papadopoulos, a historian, political analyst, and author, who joins us from London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Let me first start with you, Sid Mohammed Marandi. You are in Vienna, and it's a pleasure actually to have you and for you to take this time out to talk to us, because obviously your introspective on this is very important given the fact that geographically you are there. Do you think, based on the 3 days of talks, that the U.S., I'm sorry, that that was a slip, that the P4+1 has actually come to these talks with the way that Iran has termed the talks as sanctions lifting nuclear talks to be occurring? Is that the approach that has been taken by them?
Well, the Russians and the Chinese are very much on Iran's side. They support the Iranian position. They openly supported the Iranian position at the negotiating table in a very impressive way. The Europeans, they are basically not the decision makers. They are countries that on appearances, they are sovereign and independent, but sadly they are on the decline and they are increasingly dependent on decisions that are made in Washington, or they obey decisions that are made in Washington. So it's no secret that the Europeans are constantly in contact with the United States. And so we have to see if the Europeans at the negotiating table, through whatever mechanisms that they use, if they're willing to abide by their commitments that they signed up to and the Americans signed up to in 2015. Remember, the Americans, after the deal was signed, they immediately began violating the deal. You know this as well as I, so do many of your viewers, that Obama, he told the U.S. Treasury to threaten banks, for example, not to work with Iran. And that is a direct violation of the deal, because the deal basically said that the United States must not impede the normalization of Iranian trade. Obama did the exact opposite. So that's one reason why the Iranians are now saying that there must be verification. On the other hand, when Trump came to power, he began to impose all sorts of sanctions. He left the deal, of course. But all of the sanctions, whether he claimed they were about human rights or missile technology or terrorism or anything else, it was all a part of the maximum pressure campaign. And the maximum pressure campaign was to force Iran to accept changes to the nuclear deal. So the Iranians are saying that all those sanctions have to be removed, A, because they were part of a campaign to force Iran to appease the United States, and B, because those sanctions impede the normalization of Iranian trade, which must be facilitated in accordance with the nuclear deal. So the Iranians are waiting to see if the Europeans and their allies are willing to abide by the nuclear deal. They've caused a lot of suffering, and they are in no position to make excessive demands towards Iran.
Sure. Let's break this open a little bit. One of the points that Marcus Papadopoulos, our guest there, Sir Mohammed Marandi, made, and that is the actual functionality of the European side and the depth or the lack of depth that they have in terms of decision-making, something that Iran has actually observed and said that the European side is does not really, it doesn't appear that they have any clearance, really, to make decisions, to make approvals on certain issues, perhaps, and that they need to discuss this with officials either higher up in the government or ultimately they have to go to the American side and see what they have to say. How do you view the way that they're functioning in these sanctions lifting talks?
It should be said, first of all, that it is deeply regrettable that the meeting in Vienna is occurring in the first place, because had America not withdrawn from the JCPOA and then subsequently placed sanctions on Iran, then undoubtedly the deal, which is a landmark treaty for trying to usher in a degree of peace and stability in what is the most volatile parts of the world, would be, overall and relatively speaking, in good condition. And I cannot begin to emphasize the significance of having a positive outcome to this meeting in Vienna, because if there is no agreement, if the sanctions on Iran are not lifted, then it is possible, just possible, that America and Israel might rely on the military option to prevent Iran from developing uranium for civilian purposes. It is very, very worrying and very dangerous. And as regards to the Europeans, well, America is present at the meeting in Vienna through Britain, because after all, Britain and America are kindred spirits. When it comes to Germany and France, whilst both countries deep down would like to see the JCPOA survive and prosper, at the end of the day, both of them are subservient to America. Both of them are politically, economically, and militarily dependent on Washington. And so it is inconceivable that the French and the Germans will voice the opinion in Vienna that America should lift its sanctions. Because if America was to recede the sanctions which Trump placed on Iran following Washington's withdrawal from the JCPOA, then it is conceivable that the JCPOA could continue, even without America present. But the chances of America lifting the sanctions are nil. After all, Joe Biden has criticized numerous aspects of Donald Trump's foreign policy, but he has never condemned Donald Trump for having placed sanctions on Iran following Washington's departure from the JCPOA. So quite frankly, the presence of the Europeans in Vienna amounts to nothing.
Well, to understand the progress or lack of it, depending on how you look at it, say, Mohammed Marandi, that has been made, one has to refer first to what Iran has said, and that is, you know, we are going to continue where Iran left off, even though they have said that that is only a draft and there's no concrete agreement made, and that that could be also altered or negotiated. So your take on that statement from Iran, and also the fact that, according to one source, for example, stating that 70 to 80% of the text has actually been written, and of course Iran's lead negotiator said, but it's not over until an agreement has been reached. If you can give us your understanding on that.
Well, I can't comment on 70 or 80% because it really doesn't mean anything. what constitutes 70%, what constitutes 80%, what constitutes 60%. So I really can't comment on that. What I can say is that the Iranians have not accepted the first six rounds as definitive, as you rightly pointed out. They said that we'll go over them, those issues or those things that have been written, those elements of that have been negotiated and discussed that are acceptable to Iran will be approved, and those which are not will have to be renegotiated and changed. So it's not a rejection of the past six rounds, and it's not a an approval of everything that happened during the past 6 weeks, and I think it's a logical position to take. Those six rounds were negotiated, nothing was final, and the new team has to, as they pointed out, everything has to be resolved before a decision is made. So everything that would mean that those six rounds, what was discussed in those six rounds, is a part of that broader package. But the most, I think the most important thing that is impedes an agreement is the United States not being able to make a decision. The United States feels that it has too many problems at home. Biden is weak. He's unpopular. His opponents are well ahead of him in the polls. Trump is well ahead of him in the polls. And he doesn't want to be seen as weak. And that puts him in a weak position to make a decision. And on the other hand, the American arrogance always impedes the United States from doing the right thing at the negotiating table. So I would be very cautious about any prospects for a deal because of U.S. traditional arrogance and also problems at home. But at the same time, if the United States were to take everything into account, the fact that China is on the rise, Russia is on the rise, the United States is in a very difficult situation in West Asia, the costly wars have led ultimately to the really embarrassing retreat from Afghanistan, the United States has to cut costs. And they've already lost to China the economic war. But still, if they want to compete in some meaningful way, they have to cut their costs. And the smart thing for the United States to do, with Iran growing more powerful in the region, its allies growing more powerful in the region, the Iranian nuclear program being much more developed than it was a few years ago, the smart thing for the United States to do would be to do a deal. So the rational thing is for the Americans to end this. But since the United States is not necessarily a rational actor, then it's very difficult to say what will happen. And I don't think that anyone should count on 70 or 80% or 90% or 60% or 30% as a way to gauge whether we're heading toward an agreement or not.
Sure. The elephant in the room always remains when we talk about Iran in a sense, and that is Israel. Marcus Papadopoulos, Iran has had a reaction, or has made a statement, I should say, regarding how an accusation against Israel of trumpeting lies to poison the Vienna sanctions lifting talks. Quote, Israeli regime whose existence relies on tensions is at it again, trumpeting lies to poison the talks. All parties in the room now face a test of their independence and political will to carry out the job, irrespective of the fake news designed to destroy prospects for success. That's what Iran has said. How deep can Israel affect these sanctions lifting talks?
Well, the American-Israeli strategic partnership is of immense significance in the context of not just the Iran nuclear deal, but also any other matter concerning Iran. Firstly, the Israel lobby is immensely powerful and influential in Washington. And at the same time, Israel is America's main conduit for American power and influence, not just in the Middle East, but also in North Africa. And I'm sorry to disappoint your viewers, but there is no evidence whatsoever that America's supremacy in West Asia is in doubt. It is certainly the case that America's objective in Syria was defeated by the Syrian people and by the assistance of the Russians and the Iranians. But America's mastery in the Middle East is, as I say, is not in doubt. And when it comes to the JCPOA, the Israelis, of course, do not want America to return to the agreement. They very much want the sanctions to remain on Iran because it has weakened the Iranian economy. And in particular, it has caused a lot of suffering for the ordinary Iranian man, woman, and child. And for America, the sanctions on Iran mean that the chances in the eyes of Washington of the Iranian economy collapsing and as a result bringing down the Iranian authorities is more and more possible. So that is why the Americans will not return to the Iran nuclear deal and they will not recede the Trump-era sanctions. Let us not forget that Joe Biden is a self-professed Zionist. He has no respect for the Iranian revolution. He wants to see the Iranian revolution destroyed as much as Trump does, as much as Obama does, etc., etc. So the American-Israeli factor when it comes to the JCPOA right. is, in my opinion, of paramount importance.
Okay, one issue that we're facing here, and we're hoping that you can clarify this for us, Professor Morandi, is the fact that you have, like I'm looking at this, what's called a Johnson-led bill that would subject any future agreement to a two-thirds majority vote in the Senate, which makes it even harder for the talks to succeed. And if there was any type of success there, that you know, it's going to still get rejected by these hawkish Republican lawmakers. I mean, we're looking at the midterms coming up, and perhaps they're going to take over. Are we looking, even if there was a success here, that this could still get rejected at home and therefore not be applicable?
It's not really important for Iran what the problems inside the United States are. The Iranians are expecting the United States to abide by its commitments. If the United States can't, then that's something that the international community will see. The very fact that the Iranians are at the negotiating table is to show the international community who is serious and who's not. It was the United States that walked away from the deal. It was the United States that tore apart the deal. It was the United States that imposed its will upon the Europeans, and it was the United States and the Europeans that imposed maximum pressure on ordinary women and children. But they failed. And while your guess is correct, the United States is still a powerful force in West Asia, but the United States is on the decline. There's no doubt about that. China is surpassing the United States. I think it has surpassed the United States, but you know that's debatable. The United States rivalry with Russia, China, and Iran is very costly, and the Americans are basically spending trillions of dollars on three fronts, and it's not sustainable. As your guest rightly pointed out, the United States and the apartheid regime are very, very close, and Biden himself is an advocate, like other American politicians, of apartheid. And there's a consensus among Republicans and Democrats. But in any case, the Iranian position is clear. Iran is growing more powerful in the region. Iranian allies are growing more powerful in the region. The Iranian nuclear program is not something that the Americans can stop. Any military attack by the Israelis would be met with a disproportionate response. And any attack by the United States would mean the devastation and destruction of those countries in the region which have allowed the United States to carry out these attacks, countries with which have American bases. And that would lead to a global economic catastrophe. So there is a sort of balance of power at play here. The Americans are not going to engage in war with Iran, and the Israelis, if they carry out an attack, they would be met with of disproportionate response. So either we're going to have stalemate, but even with stalemate, the maximum pressure campaign has failed. And increasingly, countries and neighboring countries are going to do trade with Iran, especially with the new policy of the new administration. And China and Russia are going to have to increasingly ignore the United States because the U.S. sanctions are a threat to their future as well. And with the development of the new technologies, blockchain technology, and other new means of carrying out trade and business, it's going to be increasingly difficult for the United States to enforce its sanctions in future. And as we are seeing, despite the great difficulties that ordinary Iranians or people with lower incomes in Iran face, the United States simply has no more leverage. They've done all they can, and they failed. So if the United States wants the Iranian nuclear program to develop, and if the United States wants Iran, Russia, and China to move closer to each other, it's pursuing the right policy.
We're going to end it there. Thank you, Sayed Mohammed Mirandi. In Vienna, a pleasure talking to you, university professor and political analyst. And in London, Marcus Papadopoulos, historian, political analyst, and author. Thank you both for your input.
Thank you.
And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. Thanks for being with us. From Miko Batahwei and the entire team of the capital, Tehran, it's goodbye.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn, alayhis salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. My name is Muhammad, and I'm invited by Brother Mahdi to this segment of the program. Today, I'd like to read to you a passage about Islamic lifestyle according to Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. This passage is extracted from a book titled The Life of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Baqir, written by the great Iraqi Muslim historian and scholar Allama Baqir Sharif al-Qurashi. This great Muslim scholar and historian was born in 1344 AH in the city of Najaf. He's well known for his books on the biography and conduct of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. Please stay with me. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam warned the Muslims from anger. He provided a remedy for it. He, peace be upon him, said, "Indeed,
This anger is an ember from Satan. The ember is burned in the heart of the son of Adam, that is man. When one of you becomes angry, his eyes become red and his jugular veins become swollen. Thus, Satan enters him. When he becomes angry, he must sit on the ground. With that, he removes the cunning of Satan.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's wonderful to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Imam al-Baqir, alayhi salam, the fifth divinely appointed imam, has some very beautiful and profound dialogues, conversations which are rather short, usually in a question and answer format, but despite them being short and concise and precise, we find that they are full of a world of wisdom and knowledge. And now, mind you, these questions are not easy questions. At one point, Imam al-Baqir is requested to speak about the people of heaven and the people of hell. And so Imam al-Baqir, alayhi salam, he says that the people of the garden, the people of paradise, the people of heaven will enter the garden, the heaven, through their deeds. So we must remember that it is our deeds and our actions which are really important, and it is our deeds and our actions which count. Yes, our intention to do good is accepted and it is valued and it is the first step, but an intention to do good without actually doing the good, well, that doesn't make sense. So yes, our intention needs to be good, but to follow up on our intention and to complete the circle, we need to do good deeds. After this, the companion asked, "Will Allah release some people from the fires of hell?" Imam al-Baqir, Allahu Akbar, God is great, Allah is great. Imam al-Baqir shows us how merciful and forgiving Allah is. Imam al-Baqir says, Allah will release some people from the fires of hell. So, dear friends, always have hope in the mercy and the forgiveness of Allah. Always ask Allah for forgiveness. Try to refrain from committing sins. Try to improve and change your life. Do good deeds so that you will be released from the fires of hell, and you will become of the people of heaven. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Baqir, alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of the program Dialogue. I'm Atal, the producer of this program, and at this moment, I would like to invite you to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Abbas Mirza about Imam Muhammad al-Baqir, alayhi salam.
And how beautiful the role model would be when it is Bahurul Uloom. As we are fully aware of that hadith, but it is always good to remind each other and kind of look it from a deeper perspective. Why? Because everything has been said. You know, there's nothing new I could come here and speak. Everything has been revealed in the Quran. The Masumi alayhi salam have already mentioned that. The great scholars have already written in different treatises. You know, whatever required of an insan to really become perfect have been mentioned in the Quran. There's nothing new is coming now. It's really need that deeper understanding and a sort of like a, you know, crucial investigation of these realities by which we could implement into our lives, right? So it requires a new keys, you know, for the same treasure that we got. You know, this has been also mentioned by one of the great scholar, you know, who converted to Islam, Nuruddin. His name was Fritz Schwann. In one of the book called Understanding Islam, in the very foreword of this book, Understanding Islam, he writes that everything I've been mentioned, it just requires new keys. So sort of like an approach, a key towards unlocking this treasure that we already have. So the Prophet says to Jabir that you will see my grandson who is named after my name. So when you see him, give him my salam. Don't we believe when an insan reaches to that kamal, to that perfection, where is kun fayakun? When Prophet is saying salam, that means Imam Baqir is salim, is pure, is far away from all impurities. Prophet is sending salam, five generation after, and the Prophet is saying, give him my salam. So if all the believers of the Prophet come to this hadith of Jabir and understand Prophet have sent salam on Baqir Ulum, then we wouldn't be having issues that we have.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
Join us in this journey, IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt,
Indian-administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
As more cases of the Omicron variant of COVID-19 are detected in Europe, questions mount over its true origin, how contagious it is, and of course the health threat. The matter was debated in the European Parliament on Tuesday.
The thing that's really on everybody's mind is the new variant.
The head of the European Medicines Agency, Eimear Cook, told lawmakers that greater efforts are needed to get more people vaccinated in the EU.
Especially in those member states where the rates are dangerously low. And this is particularly important as we learn more about Omicron.
Even though we know little about the new variant, EU countries are increasing restrictions. Most legislators agree that vaccination rollout remains key.
We were all a bit late in preparing the booster, and it is the biggest problem is, of course, that people don't get the first and second dose.
Citizens have been reacting to the latest developments.
With this new variant, well, I don't know. I mean, the economy is not actually quite strong, I would say, so whether we really balance like health, you know, and survival.
From the stock exchange's reaction, it may have a negative impact on our lives again in terms of economy.
One quarter of adults in the EU have still not been jabbed. A contributing factor to hesitancy, it has been suggested, is the refusal of pharmaceutical giants to release vaccine clinical trial data.
This is not just an issue of taxpayers' fund, but also an issue of trust. Trust in the European institution can be built by transparency.
Many EU legislators are saying it's imperative that Omicron serves as a warning. They are again repeating a message they've been trying to send to political leaders now for almost a year. The West must stop hoarding vaccines from poorer nations, otherwise more variants and perhaps more deadly variants will be coming. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Tensions are running high between the United States and China as Washington ramps up pressure against Beijing. The Pentagon says it is planning to improve bases in Guam and Australia to counter what it calls the threat from China. The projects come as part of the U.S. military's Global Poster Review, which calls for prioritizing military construction across the Pacific Islands and additionally military cooperation with allies and partners in the region. Beijing has slammed the plan, accusing the U.S. of creating an imaginary enemy and sparing no efforts to encircle and contain China. It says Washington is using the China threat theory to expand its military presence in the region and serve its hegemonic interests. Since coming to power, President Biden has made China his main foreign policy agenda, with a focus on the Indo-Pacific region. Taiwan has been a major thorn in the deteriorating relations, as Washington has been trying to appease Taipei by arming it. That's despite repeated warnings from Beijing, which views the self-ruled island as part of its territory under the One China principle. The Sino-American standoff is not limited to Taiwan. The two have been at odds over a host of other issues. Beijing has repeatedly accused Washington of interfering in its internal affairs by fueling unrest in the semi-autonomous Chinese city of Hong Kong. Washington has also sided with Beijing's rivals in the maritime dispute over the South China Sea and routinely dispatches warships and warplanes to the region. China and the U.S. are also engaged in a trade war, with both seen imposing tit-for-tat tariffs during the previous U.S. administration. The Sino-American relationship has also deteriorated over a recently inked security pact between the U.S., Australia, and the U.K., known as AUKUS. Beijing says the trilateral partnership, which allows Australia to build nuclear-powered submarines, poses both a regional and global threat. Russian President Vladimir Putin has also accused the AUKUS alliance of fueling regional tensions. Putin's comments come as tensions are also running high between Russia and the West over a series of issues, including Ukraine. The pressure tactic by the U.S. and its allies have driven Moscow and Beijing closer than ever. Earlier this month, they signed a roadmap for closer military ties, citing growing conflict potential and frequent U.S. strategic bomber flights near their borders. Russia and China have realized that the American hegemonic goal, if unchecked, would pose a threat not only to their geostrategic interests, but other countries in the region and beyond.
No kings or queens, but a president from the ranks of Barbadians charting a path forward for the world's youngest republic.
Today, debate and discourse have become action. Today, we set our compass to a new direction, girded by the successes of the last 55 years, buoyed by the confidence garnered from our triumphs and accomplishments.
One of those accomplishments, independence from monarchical rule in 1966, more than three centuries after British settlers arrived and turned the island into a wealthy sugar colony based on the work of hundreds of thousands of African slaves. The UK's Prince Charles, who stood somberly as the new Barbados was declared, had this to say.
From the darkest days of our past and the appalling atrocity of slavery, which forever stains our history, the people of this island forged their path with extraordinary fortitude.
Some experts are saying that Barbados becoming a republic is the natural progression of a trend that started in 1952 when Queen Elizabeth II acceded to the throne. That it will accelerate, not necessarily in this reign, but perhaps in the next.
The brutal history in Barbados and other Caribbean islands has also spurred calls for reparations from the UK. For now, though, this republic of nearly 300,000 will be celebrating throwing off the shackles of British colonialism and focus on building their future Barbadian style. Saeed Puriza, London.
The nations of the English Channel and the European Commission convened in Paris following the deadliest mass drowning on record. The United Kingdom was excluded, a controversial punishment for UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson's public tweet asking for joint military patrols and renegotiations of emigration agreements. At the request of London, for the past 3 years, France has blocked all other routes to the UK, leaving dangerous sea crossings the only option. Many say that when it comes to refugees, what comes first is political considerations and not humanitarian obligations.
Once again, we're in a French election campaign which wants to scapegoat immigrants for political gain. The three top candidates, including President Emmanuel Macron, are all awful and also on the far right. Therefore, they emphasize falsehoods such as immigrants cost the state too much money, even though every study proves that the state grows fat from the taxes and cheap labor of illegal immigrants.
Primary motivation cited by refugees is to be with family members in the United Kingdom, a neo-colonial power. French officials accused the UK of economically profiting off of quasi-modern slavery by attracting refugees with the lure of not needing papers to work in the UK. Despite being militarily involved in many of the world's top refugee-producing conflicts today, the UK currently hosts around 200,000 of the world's 84 million refugees. Refugees compose just 0.25% of the UK population, while countries like Iran and Lebanon host well over 1 million asylum seekers each. Many note that while Brexit has taken the UK out of the European Union, it has not removed its commitments to international law.
France said the easiest solution is for the United Kingdom to widen its legal route for asylum seekers. Paris has long offered to let British immigration officials process asylum requests on French soil. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Twenty years of invasion and war on their soil have left Afghans critical of U.S. cruel policies. People in Afghanistan blame the U.S. for numerous crises in the country. They said many years of U.S. presence have brought them nothing but corruption, discrimination, death, and displacement. But most significantly, people complain about Washington's role in Afghanistan's ongoing crisis.
The U.S. is absolutely to blame for what is going on in our country. If Afghanistan's money was given to it, we would not be struggling with such a dire situation. The release of Afghan assets can help lower unemployment and people can have something to eat. We wouldn't be needing so much international assistance if our assets were not frozen.
This is a reality, and most of people know that the U.S. is the only cause of this worsening crisis. During the invasion, the U.S. didn't want to build up a strong government. Finally, it agreed to let it be collapsed by the Taliban. And now, under the Taliban rule, the US is pushing the people to the brink of its starvation. People are paying the price of billions of dollars of blocked assets.
Actually, the US is behind all problems in the region. What has the US served us with? Nothing. Of course, they don't, because they are invaders. The US is not honest with the people of Afghanistan. We want neighboring countries to help us in this situation.
Experts suggest that the Taliban must boost cooperation with regional countries rather than the US, and should learn from the failure of the previous government. They also believe that the Taliban should first strengthen national solidarity and legitimacy.
The US invaded our soil under the pretext of countering terrorism, but later they switched to other issues and planned another strategy, using our country as their backyard and a battlefield against their enemies. It is proven that the US doesn't want to see a stable Afghanistan. So the new government must be aware and tighten its relation with the regional countries.
The U.S. is pushing Afghanistan to the brink of a catastrophe by freezing nearly $10 billion in assets belonging to the Afghan Central Bank. That is why the Taliban have sent a high-ranking delegation to Doha to discuss these frozen assets and their opening of foreign embassies, including the U.S. embassy in Kabul. The United States keeps Afghan assets blocked while, according to UN bodies, 95% of the population is suffering from food insecurity. 97% are expected to live below the poverty line by 2022. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Iran and the remaining signatories of the nuclear deal agree to prioritize sanctions removal following a joint commission session that's kick-started a seventh round of talks aimed at reviving the JCPOA.
What we have from the previous sixth round is a draft, not an agreement, and drafts are up for negotiation. And until there is an agreement on everything, there won't be an agreement on anything.
Iran has rejected simultaneous or mutual compliance, saying the U.S. should pay the price for withdrawing from the deal. Tehran says it would only go back to compliance after the full, guaranteed, and verifiable removal of sanctions.
They can name it human rights, they can name it missile technology, Iran's regional position, they can call it global warming, whatever it is. We all know it's about hurting ordinary Iranians so that the Americans can get something from Iran. The Iranians, this administration, this negotiating team won't accept those excuses. The Americans have to go back to the JCPOA they want the Iranians to go back to the JCPOA.
The EU coordinator said he felt extremely positive about the prospect of talks, and the Russian and Chinese delegates said the Iranian team had adopted a pragmatic approach.
Since we have a serious will to negotiate and practical readiness to reach an agreement, we are optimistic about the future. But because we do not trust the other side, we are also not going to be naive.
Iran's lead delegate says he's called for guarantees the U.S. will not impose new sanctions, reimpose previous sanctions, or use the JCPOA as a means to increase pressure on the Islamic Republic. Homa Lizki, Vienna.
Years after the U.S.'s assassination of top Iranian military figure General Qasem Soleimani, the Islamic Republic continues efforts to bring the perpetrators of the assassination to justice. Soleimani was the commander of IRGC's Quds Force, which is in charge of conducting overseas operations. He, together with commander of Iraq's popular mobilization units, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, were killed in 2019 in a U.S. air raid outside Baghdad International Airport on a direct order from then-U.S. President Donald Trump.
There are two dimensions to this crime, domestic and international. Regarding the domestic aspect, the culprits are charged with terrorism, actions against national security, and murder, among other crimes. Regarding its international dimension, the U.S. has violated human rights, committed an act of terrorism, and violated many international treaties and conventions, such as paragraph 3 of the UN Resolution 1556 on terrorism.
General Soleimani holds a reputation for eliminating Daesh terrorists in Iraq in 2017. He also led major operations in Syria that led to the recapturing of key areas from Daesh. This is why the U.S.'s assassination of Soleimani led to a safe interpretation that Washington must be on the terrorist side. Tehran calls the assassination a clear example of state terrorism by the U.S.
Washington needed the terrorists to roam in our region, and that's why it killed the spearhead of the fight against terrorism. Washington has repeatedly admitted that it has created Daesh. It has been proved that the weapons used by Daesh are American, and the terrorists were trained by the U.S. and Israel. They also use American social media platform to publicize their activities and recruit more members without the U.S. taking any action to block their access.
So far, 43 people have been subpoenaed out of 128 people who have been identified in connection with Soleimani's assassination. Former U.S. President Donald Trump tops the list. Last week, Iranian judiciary officials visited Iraq to form a joint committee with Iraqi judicial experts to continue the probe into the incident. Iran's judiciary says, aside from penalizing the culprits, it is taking steps to have those involved in the matter compensate the damages inflicted to the families of the victims.
This man is known to be the nemesis of the terrorists in the region, so his assassination was a big win for the terrorists and a huge loss for the entire region. That's why the Islamic Republic says it will never back down from its legal pursuit to bring the perpetrators to justice, saying this is to make sure that such incidents will not happen again against its military figures. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Gimpo City, already famous for its busy airport, now boasts a new landmark, a park just 1.4 kilometers from North Korea. The Aegibong Peace Eco Park, the South's nearest park to the north, is already open. It features an observatory, an exhibition hall, and much more, drawing large numbers of tourists eager to get a detailed look at North Korea. The park is scheduled to be complete by June, when a skywalk linking the two facilities will become operational.
My thought about the unification between North Korea and South Korea has been changed. People coming here, I think, and North Korean people are far away from our ordinary life.
Aside from telescopes, there's a peace bell made of melted metal, including empty cartridges found at the remains of soldiers killed in the Korean War. There is also a Christmas tree which once stood at a South Korean military observatory here.
Christian groups used to hold a Christmas Eve service next to a huge lit Christmas tree visible from the north across the estuary at this observatory and broadcast the service into the north by loudspeakers. This angered Pyongyang.
I can view apartments and farmers working in fields as close as Kaepung County, and I see a higher living standard than I thought the north had.
In the exhibition hall, the north can be viewed through a glass wall. Items on display reveal Aegibong's history and the need to preserve peace in the estuary, an ecological treasure trove untouched by humans since the Korean War's end. It is home to endangered species of birds, among others. There is also a unification-promoting virtual reality train that visitors take to Gaesong right across the estuary from the park, the next best thing to actual travel.
Visitors see images recovered with 3D technology of UNESCO World Heritage Sites in Gaesong.
The 17-day Gimpo Peace Festival, held last month to mark the park's launch and foster North-South peace and reunification, featured a tour press briefing by Gimpo's mayor and a peace conference by ambassadors on October 5th, when foreign journalists got a sneak preview of the park before it opened 2 days later.
I believe visitors do not need to fear a North Korean attack here, since the world's powerful nations will not let a second Korean War occur.
Aegibong Peace Eco Park, which has replaced the South's military observatory in Gimpo, has been popular, drawing 15,000 tourists since opening. Not surprisingly, the park, which offers free admission through this year, is due to start charging an entrance fee soon, beginning next year. Jennifer Chang, Gimpo, South Korea.
Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi has attended the 15th summit of the Economic Cooperation Organization in Turkmenistan. Addressing the one-day summit on Sunday, he assured Iran's neighbors that Washington's sanctions will have no bearing on regional cooperation and interaction.
The United States' cruel sanctions against Iran will not have the slightest impact on the Islamic Republic of Iran's policy of maximum interaction with neighboring and regional countries.
Raisi called on member states to work together in a range of fields, from the creation of a regional electricity market to water transfer projects, as well as energy ventures. He also proposed creating an internal financial mechanism by the Economic Cooperation Organization to boost its efficacy. On the sidelines of the summit, Raisi held a string of high-level bilateral meetings to discuss ways to develop relations. The Iranian president has time and again said boosting cooperation with neighboring countries is one of the major goals of his administration. He believes that approach will help improve economy as well as peace and stability in the region. Iran took a big step in this regard in September when it formally became a full member of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. That's a Eurasian political, economic, and security alliance, accounting for about one-third of the world's land and exporting trillions of dollars in goods annually. Recently, Iran's Deputy Foreign Minister Ali Bagheri Kani traveled to several regional countries, including Qatar, the United Arab Emirates, and Oman, for talks on expanding bilateral cooperation. This month, he also went to four European countries, namely France, Germany, Britain, and Spain, where similar talks took place. Bagheri Kani's European tours came ahead of talks set to begin Monday in Vienna. The talks taking place between Iran and other remaining signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal aim to remove sanctions on Tehran. Those sanctions took effect after the U.S. left the nuclear deal in 2018 as part of its so-called maximum pressure campaign, seen as an attempt to isolate Iran in international arena. More than 3 years into that policy, it seems that it has failed, with Iran expanding ties with countries in the region and beyond while being accepted by more international bodies.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me, proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away, proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. Before we deal with the law of istihada and fluid discharge, which is the topic today and inshallah in the upcoming episodes, let's take a listen to a short biography of Ayatollah Sistani.
The Grand Ayatollah Sistani comes from the family of scholars and pious men. He learned theological and rational sciences from many eminent and well-known religious scholars. At the age of 5, His Eminence started learning the Holy Quran. He was then admitted in a religious center for reading, writing, and for learning basic mathematics and geography. In the beginning of 1360 Hijri, he started studying basic Hauza lessons. He also studied a number of books on philosophy like Sharh Manzuma Sabzawari and Sharh Ishraq. Meanwhile, he attended Kharij lectures by the late Mirza Mehdi Ashtiani and the late Mirza Hashim Qazvini.